The Mexican government is the cartel. The words of a high-level U.S. government informant. Stay tuned and listen to them yourself.
Caught you walking like a gangster. Saw you grabbing the controls. Now you're almost out of batteries. You got a sweater much too small. Poking at your navel. Point your finger to. Lips don't even stick together when the dust comes up. Going across the plains, pictures are falling in and out of the frame, singing good and evil.
Good and evil. This is true evil today. Welcome me and Mark back to the airwaves.
Hey,
welcome,
buddy, Mark. How you doing?
Yeah, and we're back with a show. When the information started coming through from our guest, I literally exploded and said, man, we've got, nobody is putting this stuff on the air, and it's ridiculous. We're talking about 12 homicides. We're talking about the attempted murder of an American DEA agent, the murder of an American citizen. Was it funded by a U.S. government undercover operation? Was the Mexican government apprised of it? Who allowed this murder and torture operation to continue uninterrupted with a U.S. government informant tape recording secretly some of these murders, at least? On today's show, we're gonna play a recorded interview between one of our guests, Bill Conroy, who, in my opinion, should get a Pulitzer Prize for this, his reportage on the House of Death series, and the informant himself. Also on the air with us is Sandy Gonzalez, the DEA agent, the DEA supervisory agent, who tried to blow the whistle on this whole sordid operation, this whole ghastly conspiracy that goes against everything that is American, that goes against everything that is in my training, in my way of thinking, good, honest. It's a horror. And can we, as American citizens, allow this to go unpunished or not even looked at, not even examined?
Undiscovered.
Yeah, undiscovered. The mainstream media is not touching it in spite of our reportage. So we, on today's show, we actually have the informant's voice himself. And let me just read something from one of the stories on narconews.com by the only reporter covering this, Bill Conroy. And I'm just going to read a part of this, and it talks about the retirement of Johnny Sutton. Johnny Sutton was the lead U.S. prosecutor for the Western District of Texas, and it talks about his retirement on April 19th. And he made his media bones, so to speak, when he prosecuted two U.S. Border Patrol agents who shot a drug dealer in the butt. And he got them confined. They were sentenced to 10 years in prison each. An armed drug dealer, by the way. And this is the same man who now we'll pick up from there with Bill's piece, which, quote, Sutton's pending departure from the U.S. attorney post based in San Antonio, Texas, provided an opportunity for the Texas media to revisit that case and to once again give Sutton a soapbox to defend his prosecution of the Border Patrol agents as being just, though resulting in sentences that he agrees were too harsh but beyond his control. But that same media was silent about another case marked by the fingerprints of Sutton, one that cost the lives of at least a dozen people, and which to this day remains mired in a cover-up that reaches up to the top of the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security. The murders were carried out in 2003 and early 2004 with the assistance of a U.S. government informant overseen by federal agents seeking to make a drug case for Sutton against a Juarez, Mexico-based narco-trafficker named Heriberto Santillán Taveras. That case, dubbed the House of Death, also nearly resulted in the assassination of a DEA agent and his family at the hands of the Santillan criminal cell as a result of decisions made by Sutton's office that permitted their informant to continue his homicidal assignment. That callous indifference to life, arguably complicity in murder, seemed to work to Sutton's advantage, allowing him to potentially lay claim to a big drug case stat to feather his hat and advance his political fortunes. But a lone DEA commander in El Paso, Texas, threatened to unravel Sutton's glory when he wrote a memo delivered to Sutton decrying the needless murders in the House of Death case and the inexcusable actions of those who allowed the informant to aid and abet those crimes with the blessings of federal agents and prosecutors. Sutton is no amateur when it comes to the ancient political art of sticking the knife in the back of a perceived enemy. However, and that DEA agent, Sandy Gonzalez, was deemed such a threat. It is my honor and my privilege to bring back to the microphones here in New York City both Sandy Gonzalez and Bill Conroy, and welcome, guys.
Thanks, Mike.
Was that Sandy?
Yeah.
Sandy and Bill, welcome. I think we'll start with you, Bill. Bill, you actually, you know, we've covered this story pretty well, and I was always telling, I would say to the audience, look, you know, I've been cursed by being trained by the Department of Justice and putting together a conspiracy, and putting together a conspiracy, you put the informant before a grand jury, or you report what the informant says to the grand jury, and you tell them he's reliable, and you indict people. You put him away for, in this case, aiding and abetting murder, conspiracy to murder, conspiracy or aiding and abetting in the attempted murder of a DEA agent, etc., etc., etc. But nobody's done that. So we're going to take one step further here on this show. We're actually bringing the informant on the air through you, Bill. Why don't you just kind of introduce how this interview went down and what the informant, I think it's Guillermo Peyro, no?
Ramirez Peyro.
His
nickname is Lalo.
Lalo. Okay, so let's talk about, just tell the audience pretty much, you know, what set up this interview and how it went down, what you had to do, and then we're going to play it for all of us to just talk about and see if I can stop foaming at the mouth. Go ahead, my friend.
Well, essentially, the informant's sitting in prison now, and they're trying to deport him to Mexico. And he reached out saying he was interested in talking, telling his side of the story. So over the last, now I guess it's been three weeks, we've been talking by phone from, he's calling me from prison. And recently I asked him, I said, well, would you mind if I tape recorded this? And there's a radio show in New York interested in putting it on the air, because I wanted to be up front with the guy. And he said, sure. So essentially we tape recorded a recent conversation, kind of going over what we had talked about in at least 3 hours of prior interviews, condensing it and kind of trying to get across what happened in this case from his point of view. And that's what this tape is, essentially.
Okay, so it's going to be an eyewitness view of the House of Death, how it began. The first tape, we have three tapes. I'm going to leave it up to Mark how we're going to give this to our audience. But I want to tell our audience, you guys right now are the first and only audience in the United States to not only really know this, the whole inside and out story of the House of Death that's been absolutely uncovered by media, but you're the first to hear this voice, the voice of the actual informant, who, if our government has its way, will soon be among those pushing up daisies, as they say. So, go ahead, Marcus.
Lal, can you tell the listeners your name and where you're calling from right now?
Yes, my name is Guillermo Eduardo Ramirez Peyro, and I'm calling from Sherburne County Jail here in Elk River, Minnesota.
Okay, and the government's trying to deport you right now to Mexico. What is your feeling about what would happen to you if you're deported, and who would do it to you?
Well, I'm absolutely sure I'm going to be killed by the by the Juarez cartel or the Mexican government, which is basically the same thing. And in the last years, I've been working over there with ICE, and we infiltrate the cartel just to find that the Mexican government at all levels of the, especially the law enforcement agencies, they are corrupt and they are being paid for the cartel, and actually they are the cartel. I'm very sure that they're
going to
kill me.
Oh, they're right there.
Yeah, okay, let's start right there. Sandy Gonzalez, let's begin with you. You are a hands-on DEA top-level supervisory agent. In your experience, is what this informant said true, that all, you know, basically when you're dealing with the Mexican cartels, you're dealing with the Mexican government?
Well, I guess the bottom line is that nothing has changed since your case, right?
I don't see it. I mean, that's why I found listening to this informant, what I found really depressing about this is that the whole U.S., all the populace of the United States now is being treated to this alleged war between the Mexican government and the cartel, when in fact it's like a mafia war, really, an intestine gang war, from my point of view. And the entire U.S. population is being misdirected by a horrific media. What do you both think of that?
Well, this campaign, I think... They have to do it to save face. There's not going to be an admission of corruption, which of course goes into the other the argument that the government's making for deporting Ramirez Payroll. This is just unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. When you listen to the rest of this first tape and you hear the specific involvement and the alleged phone calls to the Mexican government about the murders, and even a listener who's untrained in police work and conspiracy. I understand a lot of this is difficult for people who are untrained to comprehend and wrap their heads around. I try to explain some of this. Well, I'm constantly trying to explain some of this to my wife, Laura, the lovely Laura Cavanaugh, who's a lot brighter than me. And she constantly remarks. She said, probably a lot of journalists who try to report on this find this too difficult to comprehend.
It's not a bumper sticker story by a long shot. And I also want to say, for listeners who have any interest at all, go to the website, because along with this show, I'll have linked all the, and I want to say we've done nine hours on this story so far. It's very thick, and it's not the kind of thing that you can encapsulate in a soundbite.
Somebody try to encapsulate it for me. I think that paragraph that came out, the couple of paragraphs that came out of Bill Conroy's reportage did it. But how do you tell people, what is this about? I mean, what is
no,
this?
No, I think you're right. Yeah, I think those paragraphs did it.
And okay.
All right, so you want to play next?
I want people to understand the danger, what this man went through and the dangers he's facing, and why our government wants him deported right away before media actually starts to listen to him. Go ahead.
All right, here we go.
Well, let me tell you, I started working for ICE in the summer of 2000, and in the beginning of 2001, we found a way to infiltrate the Juarez cartel, and immediately I let them know that this was a very, very dangerous organization, that just the person who I can start working on, he just let me know how many people he already killed, since he was working there for about a year. And I explained this because I was worried that they weren't very professional in their covering of me in the prior cases we were working. So that's when I started doing this. It was January 2001. I started working with the Juarez cartel, so I asked him, and they said, they give the yes, go ahead to infiltrate the Juarez cartel.
Can you tell me a little bit about the how you got involved with the House of Death, how that all started initially, and what your job
was? Well, the House of Death, everything started there with the cartel in, it was, I believe, August 2003. And the first thing we have to go over to start doing over there, we received there. I have to go over there with two state police just to wait that Santillan and Alex Garcia bring an individual named Fernando Reyes. They bring him over there so the state police can kill him and bury him there in the yard, because Santillan wants to steal from him 1,000 pounds of marijuana he already received from him. So that house started being a place for torture, or just receive people the bodies of people who came already dead, just to be buried in the backyard of that house.
Now, after that, the murder of the Lord Fernando Reyes, you were there when that happened, right? And then, secondly, when did you report it to ICE, and who did you report it to there?
Well, I found that day that we have to do that operation, so I start recording everything from the beginning, so everything was very clear. How first Alex Garcia explained the plan, and then Santillan basically gave me the orders, repeating the same as Alex was told me. This was about 10 in the morning, 9:10 in the morning. So I went with the state cops. I wasn't want to be over there in the house because I was afraid. So that was a very weird situation. So I was afraid that I was the one who was about to get killed. Because of my work with ICE, we have just bust several different drug loads from the cartel. So I think they already suspect of me. So what I did, I just put the state police people inside the house, and I use excuses to go out and bring like lime or duct tape or water or whatever. I was thinking I wasn't. At some point, Santillan and Alex Garcia, when I was getting out, arrived with this guy and with Fernando Reyes, and they just bring him inside, and Santillan left, just told Fernando Reyes, okay, give Lalo, which is me, the phone numbers in New York so he can deliver your merchandise. So I was writing in the numbers when the disguise of the state police jumped on Fernando, and they control him, and at the end I killed him by asphyxia. So Alex told me, hey, the boss said you go and bring him when he's done, so go and bring him now. So I left. We went to meet Santillan, who was just around the corner in a little store. And we come back. So then Santillan introduced us to the state police officers and make us exchange numbers. And then everything comes back to normality. He said, hey, you Lalo, come with me. Let's go to see where this guy used to live, in Fernando. And then we went to a safe house, where he was residing, so he can introduce me, because they were about to go out of the city, and I had to be in charge of in case of anything happens. So we did that, and then he dismissed me. He said, "All right, you can go and whatever you have to do. Just be sure that night you come back to that house, because the state police gonna be there again and give them this money." And just supervise that they make the hole and bury this individual. So that was almost like 1 o'clock when we finished. So I immediately I go to, I call my control agent Raul Bencomo, and I head to El Paso, Texas, to the U.S. soil. And I call him and told him, hey, I need to speak urgent with you. Something very bad happens. So he told me to went to the office. When I arrived there, I met like the usual. I used to work like with two groups of narcotics and one of fraud. So over there, I remember it was this Curtis Compton, one the supervisor of one of the narcotics groups. It was Raul Bencomo. And several other agents, I don't really remember. I told them, hey, you know what, these guys just killed a man, and I got the recording of what happened right here. So I remember the first question from Curtis Compton. He said, who pulled the trigger? So I said, no, it wasn't a trigger. They just said it was by asphyxia. So they played the recording, and then they placed me in another office and bring an officer from the sheriff's department from El Paso and another agent from ICE then. But one who wasn't in our group, so they work with me in that recording, and we elaborate what happened and everything. And I also know that they let everybody know in the office all the way up to the RAC, the regional agent in charge. And he actually called the Mexican government trying to get this in Mexico City. I think this Vasconcelos, José Luis Vasconcelos, was the name of the drug, anti-drug czar over there. But the answer from the Mexican government was that they were very busy because they just killed 11 federal agents in Nuevo Laredo City. So they don't really care about one more during Ciudad Juarez. That was the answer from the Mexican government. And after going through everything what happened, they
you have 1 minute left.
You know what, if something like this happens again, you don't record it. But now go back and pay the state police and do whatever Santillan told you. Supervise the people making the hall or whatever they have to do, and then come back to the office. So that's what I did. Like at 10 at night, I arrived to that house and give the money to the state police agents and stay there until the other people dig the hall. And then I just come back to the office about 3 in the morning to the Office of Homeland Security over there in El Paso, Texas, like at 3 in the morning, just debrief what happened. And that basically that was it, what happened that day.
Wow, so to give you like a really brief synopsis of that, what you just heard was an informant describing that he actually tape-recorded the asphyxiation and murder of someone, came across the border to El Paso, Texas, met with federal authorities, played them the tape recording, and they said, okay, great, go back, just don't record any more of them.
Let me, Sandy, you've been on this. I mean, this has been your life for years now, Sandy Gonzalez. You've got how many years with DEA? 35?
Well, 32 altogether. But
who's counting?
With DEA.
Yeah, well, me too. I got 25. So you and I have and we both were supervisory agents. Let me ask you, this guy comes to you as an informer. You and I have both handled thousands of informers with the same story. Well, what do you do? What does the law say you do? What are you supposed to do?
Well, at the very least, you take some action to prevent any further murders, which they didn't do. You try to coordinate some kind of investigation with the Mexican authorities, and in that regard, he talks about a call to the Mexican authorities. What we have on the record is a letter that was written from the ICE attaché in the embassy to the Mexican Attorney General's office advising them of an informant who witnessed a murder somewhere in Chihuahua. They didn't say where. And asking for them to continue using the informant, and at some time in the future they would make the informant available to the Mexican authorities for debriefing.
Holy man. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. That's like HS, holy S. I can't believe it. In that letter, and tell me if I'm wrong, in that letter I see what already begins is a cover-up of the knowledge the U.S. Justice Department has of the murders. Am I wrong, Sandy? I mean, you as a conspiracy investigator, the intent of that letter... we got to cut 1 second while I shut my fucked-up cell phone off, and this will be cut out of the show, guys.
Oh, no, I'm leaving that in. Are you kidding?
Yeah. It's got to be my wife. Anyway.
You're coming in a little weak.
Okay.
He was answering his cell phone.
I had to turn my cell phone off. Sorry, Sandy. So what I see, what drives me absolutely crazy is, because I know pretty much of the whole story now, what I see is the beginning of the cover-up right there by the Justice Department, with that kind of vague letter, vague letter to the Mexican government, which they're asking for, it seems to me, they're asking for the Mexican government to okay them to continue undercover in what they now know is going to be a series of murders.
Well, you're right, and in the letter they never mentioned in the letter that the informant taped it and that they have evidence of the murder.
Well, I was going to ask
the informant witnessing it.
I was going to ask about the fact that they told him not to record anymore.
Yes.
When that's been something, I mean, he's established, and this is something else I found interesting. I thought that he was somebody who they approached who was already involved in the organization. I didn't realize that he'd been working with ICE prior to all of this starting. But
yeah,
I find
he actually.
I was just going to say, I find it interesting that they told him to stop recording.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Go ahead.
That's criminal intent, by the way.
If
we were going to go to a grand jury against those people in the Justice Department that knew about this, and then told the informant stop recording it, I mean, from my rather trained point of view, that's evidence of intent to cover up.
Right.
Oh
so,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Bill, you were starting to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say that he actually the informant. Was a Mexican cop for a while. Then he quit, and he did work in the drug business in Mexico, but not in Juarez. And then he ended up getting moved to Juarez, where he was still in the drug business. And at that point, he decided that he wanted to work for ICE, and he crossed the bridge and basically got hooked up as an informant. So he's got a long history connected to, you know, like he said, when he was a Mexican cop. I mean, it's not a big jump to go into the drug business.
Right.
I mean, the one thing that's abundantly clear is if he goes back to Mexico, the man is absolutely dead. There's just no two ways about it. If he goes back to this country where, whether you want to debate it or not, the drug cartels weigh a huge amount of influence in what that government does. So what chance does this guy have? What's your estimation? I mean, my estimation is that he's got a bona fide claim that he goes back, he's dead. Go ahead.
Oh, you know, there's no question, Mike. And an immigration judge agreed with him. And in fact, when you listen to that hearing, the U.S. government accepts that as a fact, that he's going to get killed in Mexico. But basically they say he's going to get killed, but it's okay because technically, you know, it'll be all right because it won't be under the color of law.
Yeah, well, essentially they're his argument not to be deported is under the U.N. Convention Against Torture, and that requires that the U.S. government can't send anyone back to a country where the government of that country would participate in his murder. And so our prosecutors, or the U.S. prosecutor trying to send him back, agrees that he'll be killed and that it'll be the cartel that'll kill him, but that it won't be the Mexican government. And the judge has even brought up, well, if it's a Mexican cop that turns him over to the cartel, or these Mexican cops actually participate in his murder, isn't that the government? And their argument is, well, no, if they're murdering people, it's on their own time. So they're not working for the government when they commit the murder. That's literally what they're arguing.
Oh, man. All right, listen, we got to take a break for the half hour. We're speaking with Bill Conroy and Sandy Gonzalez about the House of Death story. Everybody just stand by for 60 seconds. We'll be right back with you.
You are listening to the Expert Witness Radio Show. For more information on tonight's show, please visit us on the web at www.expertwitnessradio.org.
We're back with you guys, and I hope all of you listening right at this moment are calling your friends, or you can get up on our website and download this show and spread the word. I mean, that's what we want, the expert witness SWAT team of truth, to spread the word around, I don't know, a dormant, dead media, whatever you want to call it, a media that, in my opinion, allowed our covert agencies, our Justice Department, to just deteriorate to where we're not protected and we have no justice system. And you know, that could not happen if media was appropriately covering these stories, such as the House of Death. And I don't know, what Bill, you got, both of you gentlemen, you've been trying to get some mainstream media coverage of this since it began. And what are you running into? What are you still running into? I mean, this is so outrageous to me. But then again, I was only a federal agent, not a journalist. What's the situation, Bill?
I can't speak for other media. There's been, you know, coverage of what I call the drug war pornography aspect of it, like, you know, the blood and guts. But when you, the cover-up itself and the complicity or alleged complicity of the U.S. government in this, that's where, you know, everyone stops. There's really been no coverage of that aspect of it. And to the point where a major document that should be released under FOIA, and there's been multiple FOIA requests, the JAT report, which was, you know, 40 interviews with all these players involved that would lay out in part what happened, the government has been able to conceal that and not release it. And there's been, you know, no pressure from anyone in the media of any sort to get it released. That's probably the one thing that's kind of mind-boggling.
The JAT report. Now, how can people listening right now get sufficient information, Bill, for everybody out there to start writing letters about the JAT report and the release of the JAT report? Where can they find that? Can we go to your website? I want to arm as many listeners as I can with what's going on and what they can do about it.
Yeah, we've done a couple stories. I can send you the links so you can put on your site about what the JAT report is and what the arguments have been so far, as to why the government won't release it and the FOIA requests that have been filed, both by me but by other parties as well, and they're still, you know, acting on it.
Yeah, just give us a quick explanation. Give the listeners a quick explanation of what the JAT report is.
Well, Sandy knows. Sandy was part of it. He can explain it.
Go ahead, Sandy. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I can tell you exactly what it is. It came about as a result of disagreement between ICE and DEA. You know, when this happened on the 14th of January, and there was a perceived, or there was a threat against DEA agents, an investigation started immediately, and DEA and ICE in El Paso were reporting their findings to headquarters. And at the headquarters level, our people met, and the stories didn't jive. You know, what ICE was reporting to their headquarters was not the same as what we were reporting to our headquarters. So they decided to form a team of four people, two from DEA and two from ICE, to go out to El Paso, Mexico City, and Juarez and interview everybody involved and
was
report
Johnny
their
Sutton,
findings. But
was Johnny Sutton interviewed?
Well, I'm not sure if Johnny Sutton was interviewed himself, but I know the prosecutors were.
Yeah. Okay.
But see, you're gonna appreciate this, Mike, because this was not called an investigation. This was called an assessment or a management review. In other words, it was never intended to be presented to a prosecutorial authority for a determination of whether crimes have been committed. Okay?
Yeah, I got you.
So the whole thing was reported to both headquarters, and then it was sealed. And then when I tried to get it when I went to court for my civil case, the judge protected the government, and
the only thing
that was released was my interview, not the other 40 whatever.
Not the other 40 interviews who actually, could be witnesses against themselves. I wonder if they, for example, when you were interviewed, were you given a Miranda warning?
No. This was a review.
Yeah,
this was never intended to be an investigation. The way they put it is, whatever happened here, whatever mistakes were made, we want to make sure they don't happen again.
Right. Even if they're criminal.
Little things like that.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so, it's kind of like the Truth Commission they want to do.
Well, exactly. Who did it? OPR, Office of Professional Responsibility?
No.
Because that's what you and I both worked for.
They put OPR into it. It's a different ballgame.
And that's what I was thinking, because I was an OPR inspector, and so were you. And that's my first thought is, did they give Miranda warnings?
This was done by the chief of operations, by the operations division, and the investigators or the agents that were sent there were not part. They were part of the operations division. They were not part of the inspections division.
Okay. Let's go back to the function of payroll as an informant. I know there's always been a lot of friction between DEA, ICE, and other agencies about who's in charge of a drug investigation. Now, shouldn't DEA have been notified right from the get-go what they were doing?
Well, you know, DEA had been working with Customs together. You know, Ramirez Peiro had been a DEA informant.
Okay.
Up to the point, I think it was in July of 2003 when he was caught by the Border Patrol with a load of marijuana, which was not, he had not advised DEA about. So upon his arrest, DEA, that was a violation of his informant agreement, so DEA deactivated him.
And they flipped him and took him.
And ICE did not. ICE, in fact, ICE and the U.S. Attorney's Office got him out of jail.
Yeah, yeah. Now I understand. I understand perfectly. So from that point on, he was functioning. He was working off a beef, so to speak.
I'm just going to say really quickly, as the non-professional in the room, that this, to me, sounds like this is where the cluster, and I won't use the second part of the word, begins. There's no interagency cooperation here.
Well, if you notice, in the 9/11 commission, there was none between FBI and CIA either. In fact, there was none between FBI agents, bosses and agents. You know, we played it ad nauseum at this point, because nobody else is the FBI informant who tape recorded all his conversations with the FBI, and he tells the FBI agent, the FBI agent tells him on a recorded conversation, don't tell the other agent that I'm telling you this.
Yeah.
Do you understand? I mean, that's law enforcement today, uncovered by mainstream media. And so
we should probably get to the next part of this clip, because as it is, we're barely going to fit this in two shows.
In the ICE memo, it's mentioned that you ended up holding Reyes's legs, and then what they reported to the Mexican government is that you witnessed a murder, but you were actually in a position of having to hold this guy's legs, or they would have, as you said before, they would have killed you if you didn't participate at that point. You felt you had no choice. Is that accurate? And then also, secondly, ICE had already been informed by you that another body was buried at the House of Death, David Castro's body. So when Reyes was killed, they should have known that was the second body that was buried there, going to be buried there. Is that correct?
Well, first, I wasn't holding Fernando Reyes' legs. I pulled his leg. What happened is that Alex Garcia and one of the state police were trying to take control of his arms, of his torso, and the other agent was trying to put tape around his head, but Fernando Reyes was a tall individual. I think he was like 6'3". So he was stand up, and this guy who was trying to put the tape around his head was like 5'7", something like that. So they say, hey, we need to put him, lay him down. So I was just looking, and then they just look at me, so like saying, hey, well, help us. So what I did, I pulled his left leg. I just pulled it like that, so they can put it on the floor. That's all I did. I never get his leg. Once he was on the floor, the guy who was putting the tape around his head just get off him on his shoulders and his chest, and continue putting the the tape around his head while the other put the handcuffs on his hands and behind his back. So they don't even need Alex or me anymore. And yeah, the other thing, I was on the belief that this guy, Alex, he get paid to get rid of the body of this guy Castro, and what he did, as I know, he just buried there in his backyard. That's what I was in that belief.
And you told ICE that at some point ICE was aware before Reyes was murdered that David Castro, a U.S. citizen, his body was buried at that house of death. Is that correct?
Well, I just tell them that he was buried at a house. They don't even know where or what house or nothing else. They just don't ask further questions about that.
Yeah, but they obviously knew about the house after Reyes was murdered, so they would have known it then. But the other thing is, there were other houses where this was happening. Now, you weren't involved, but Santillan was aware these were involved in. Answer this, if he could, more fully. You did tell ICE, or ICE was made aware of that there were other houses, and what was their reaction?
Well, they don't really give a reaction. I just happened like this in several locations. There were made some operatives by the cartel in the Juarez side where I had to. They call us to be just around in case that things get like heavy. If they found heavy resistance, everybody has to give support to the team who is actually on the front. So all the time we were just like one or two blocks around, just waiting for orders, and they never called us. But we just at the end made the debrief, and Santillan all the time told me, no, well, we get this guy and we kill him and we just buried him there, and he explained us why and what they said, yeah, all the things. So I report all these situations to. Twice, but they don't say nothing really. They just heard about it. I did it more. We were supposed to be working on his case, but in those times we were more focused in other cases, like the case of the corrupt inspector, or later the case of the cigarettes. So they don't really did nothing. It wasn't something that happened in the U.S. oil, and nothing we can do, so they just listen to that.
Well, I want to stop it real quick and say what he just said is they didn't care what was happening because it wasn't on U.S. soil.
Yeah, I mean, that came across pretty clear. We've talked
about it all. We've conjectured about it. You know, I asked Bill really early on about whether this is just a case of, hey, you know, it's just a bunch of wetbacks dying down there. Is that why this is, you know, is that why nobody cares? And Bill had said, well, yeah, that's what it looks like.
Well, what we still have to talk about is, one is an American citizen who was killed. And then, again, we haven't even discussed yet how this group was intending to murder a DEA agent and his family. And that's how Sandy Gonzalez got involved. So we'll go back, play the rest of this thing, and we'll...
All right.
Yeah.
The original house, the house that we started talking about, there were about 12 other bodies buried there, and some of those were killed in the house. Was ICE monitoring your calls, and were they aware these murders were going to happen ahead of time in some cases?
Well, the thing used to work like this. Santillan used to call me and tell me, hey, send your guys to open the house. Normally I wasn't there, not even in the city. So I just called Alex and he sent someone to open the house. And yeah, sometimes I found later that what happened. And sometimes they just bring the bodies already dead, and sometimes, yeah, they bring the people alive and they kill them there. We know, like I said, like some hours before that happened, yeah.
So in other words, ICE would be, they'd call you, Santillan would call you on your phone, and ICE would have that monitored. So they hours ahead of these murders, they would know that, that they were going to have because of that. And basically, there was one other, at least one other case where two guys were murdered while you were there after Reyes. And I think those guys were, one was El Chapo and Paizo, I think is his name. They were drug mules that kind of screwed up. And you said that police commander Loya actually shot them there. Can you describe that incident?
Yeah, these guys, actually, we were just working with one. He was in charge of a unit where were smuggling drugs into the U.S. soil. So they start failing, and I tell them that I rather don't work with them because our organization were very serious, and at some point I'm going to have troubles myself and them, and these people, like they can see, they are professionals. They got the police working for them, so... I don't want any troubles. They said they want to stay working. They produce good the things for a while, not for a while, for about a week, and then they fail again. So I just told Santillan and Comandante Loya, I definitely don't want to keep working with these people. So Santillan told me, you know what? Let's get together in the morning. This was at like a 3 in the midday in the morning. So he said, let's meet tomorrow and just have some talk with them. So the next day I went over there to Juarez, and he told me, I just put an appointment in a commercial place. I did it. This guy Pais arrived with his the other guy, which he said is his compadre, and I actually, when they approached me, I was in my Suburban. And I said, hey, what's going on with this guy? What he have to do with us here? And he said, no, it's my compadre. And I asked him, hey, you want to stay with us? And they come with a third guy. And this third guy was one of the guys who used to smuggle the rock inside the USA. So they say, yeah, no, I want to stay. So I called Santillan and I say, well, we are here. And he told me, hey, you know what? Why don't you better just go to the house? And just to talk, he said, don't worry, we're just going to talk, but to be more comfortable. So I said, all right. So we went to the house, and then when Santillan arrived, it was like with another 15 state police agents, among them the Comandante Loya. And then Santillan gave me the go-ahead to start talking, so I explained to these guys the situation, that I already told them that they can mess with us, that if they don't feel respect for me, they better feel respect for the organization, because behind me there was a very big team of people, and they were messing with all of us. So then, in the meantime, Comandante Loy asked him for their IDs, and he leaped to the kitchen, and he started running that names over several channels, and then Santillan basically repeat what I told to them, and then Comandante Loya repeat it again. And at some point he said, then you know what, right now is coming the boss, so you need to cover your head. Just pull up your shirt and put it around your head. So they did it, and then he just grabbed him by the neck and put him face down on the floor. And they start to put like some kind of duct tape around their heads, but one of them started doing noise, so Comandante Loya did signs to someone to pass him a gun, and with a silencer. So he shot this guy, and the other one, he heard the shot start making noise also, and so he shot him also.
What a chilling, holy mackerel. Well, you know, but the listeners, what's clear is you had like 15 Mexican state policemen there as part of the cartel committing the murders, and all of this information going to ICE.
Who's doing nothing about it.
Yeah, who apparently. We're going to continue in the next show with this. So all you listeners, make sure you tune in next week. This show is going to be up on the website for you to listen to free of charge. So before you listen, those who you tell about the show, tell them to listen to it on our website first and listen to the continuation next week. And before we cut, do you have anything to say? Sandy, I don't know, are you as outraged as I am? How do you feel, Sandy, about this?
Well, of course I am. I mean, but it's been so long, and there's been such lack of action that I'm just, numb to this. I don't know if that makes any sense. I mean, I guess I've just accepted the fact that as a government, we're no better than anyone else.
No, God Almighty! If this doesn't prove it, nothing ever will. What came really clear is that the ICE agents told him don't record the murders anymore. And when it came to the murder of an American citizen, and he started to talk about it, they didn't ask any questions. It wasn't going to be recorded. That's why I'm so curious to see what the JAT interviews, how they would jive with this man's statements.
You know, all it would take is one member of Congress to ask for that, and they can't say no. It's not classified.
Can we listeners, have you tried a FOIA request, Bill? How about you? Have you tried a FOIA?
Yeah, there's one pending right now. They denied it, and it's on appeal.
My God. Oh God! Get us that JAT request. You know, we'll do a series of 10 shows to make sure it all goes out.
How long you been going through a dance on this JAT report?
Well, this, in my case, it's a year. But before I filed, there was another lawyer that I was working with that filed, and that was, you know, at least a year and a half on that. And so they've made all kinds of excuses. You just got to keep appealing it, you know.
Do you get a feeling that they want the informer to die first or be out of the country before that is ever released?
Oh, I have no doubt. And what bothers me also is the fact that this new administration is just like, it's just like there's been no change in government.
Yeah, you're so right. You're so absolutely,
you know?
Right.
Well, but that's a whole other thing too. Is that there's, you know, it's simple to say that, but you know, you guys know as well as anybody how deeply entrenched the Justice Department is, you know, as a whole, and to get anything done there in terms of, you know, massive change is like, you know that old saying, the more things change.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I understand it's a huge bureaucracy, but this isn't the only case. There's other cases where the Justice Department line has continued from the previous administration, and I can't believe the new people don't know about it.
No, they know. Sandy, you and I have been in those halls for too many years to know to doubt that they know 100% everything about this. And you just, what's overwhelming, I guess mind-boggling, is, you know, in the New York Police Department, they had a Serpico, you know, who came forward about a system that was totally corrupt for many, many years. A guy came forward. It was unbelievably corrupt. And I was working with New York City policemen and had been hearing this stuff and couldn't believe it. Just too overwhelmingly criminal and too overwhelmingly corrupt for an outsider to believe. And here we are with the same situation within the United States Justice Department, where, my God, you know, the corruption makes the Knapp Commission look like a walk in the park. Makes the New York City Police Corruption Unit look like absolutely nothing. What we're talking about is the aiding and abetting of murders, the aiding and abetting of attempted murder of a DEA agent, the aiding and abetting of murders of even American citizens, for those of you who think it's okay to just, you know, to authorize and stand by while Mexican citizens are killed.
And we got to remember, too, that this does matter. We're sending millions, billions of dollars to Mexico under Plan Merida, and that money's going to the cops,
to the government.
That's the cartel. We're sending money to the cartel, essentially. If you buy this informant's word, that's where that money's going.
Guys, we are. You're so right, Bill, and that's what we're trying to highlight, and where we can educate our audience. Time is up. Both of you guys are going to be back next week, and I thank the both of you for this. And Bill, this is Pulitzer Prize stuff. I don't know. I just can't believe that you're not rewarded in some way for the kind of heroism and the kind of stick. And you too, Sandy. I got to say goodbye,
gentlemen. Thank you.
Yeah, and to my wife, the lovely Laura Cavanaugh Levine. Te adoro, mamita. Allá voy. Bye.
And yeah, to all of you for listening wherever and whenever you did. Thank you, and we'll see you next time. Ciao.